Thank you very much. And you heard the man. If you know the numbers, then dial him. We'll take a bunch of your calls as we go through the evening with Dan Hurley. His website is danhurley.com. That's D-A-N-H-U-R-L-E-Y. And his book is Smarter, The New Science of Building Brain Power. Let's talk about the evil genius when we come back. And why does genius have a, at least theatrically speaking, have sort of a, well, negative connotation? How is it that the spiritually rooted hero always somehow overcomes the evil genius? And is the genius really evil? Has anybody ever heard of a beneficent genius? No. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Dan Hurley, let's retire this evil genius thing once and for all. Does that go back? Did that start with the war on the weak and the not as smart back in the Halcyon eugenics days of really pretty much the 30s and 20s?
Well, you know, the whole evil genius thing. Even my own brother, when I told him I was writing a book about how to get smarter, started giving me a hard time and saying, "Well, Mr. Schmarty, instead of getting smarter, how about you try to get nicer?" And there's certainly always been, even John Wayne, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone. How come they always played these guys that seem a little dim, and yet they're the hero? And the evil genius guy in the James Bond movie is so brilliant, and yet he's evil. It's really just a simple prejudice. Intelligence is a wonderful, wonderful ability to handle things in your life. And actually, we often hear about emotional intelligence. People that are a little brighter are generally able to control their emotions much better, and they're generally going to be higher functioning people in society. It's not just that. It's not as if you have a social brain over here and an intellectual brain over there. Yes, there are intellectuals who are, you know, socially awkward or out of touch with their feelings. But generally speaking, the two generally go hand in hand. You know, that person who is bright is going to be able to deal with the emotional aspects of their life and control their emotions just as they're able to control their thoughts and figure things out with math or so. That's the reason that if you ever think of an accountant or an engineer, you might think of them, or a rocket scientist, as kind of not very excitable, very calm, almost dull kind of people. Right. That's because they're actually able to be in control of their emotions. And that's a really powerful, wonderful thing. That's why you know, a lot of people that end up in jail and prisoners are going to be lower functioning, lower IQ folks who cannot keep their own life in control.
That's very, very interesting.
But the other side, the flip side of that, is eugenics and this whole notion that people who are intellectually challenged are weak and we should not let them reproduce. This is something that, weirdly enough, most people don't realize, that these ideas about, intelligence is all genetic and we should prune the human race from, get rid of those diseased people so that they're not infecting the rest of us, and we're not having more and more of these dependent people choking our society,
contaminating the world.
Oh yeah, these ideas started in England and were quickly adopted by the United States of America.
Yes.
So many of the people that started, you know, the whole movement for birth control and everything, that unfortunately really began with a lot of eugenic beliefs that you were going to, you know, the poor are poor because they don't have intellectual firepower, and we're going to make sure that they don't reproduce too much and ruin our wonderful country. And there were some really evil thoughts there that then got went back over the Atlantic and were adopted by the Nazis, who actually systematically tried to exterminate intellectually impaired people. And I mean, this is the height of evil. And even in the United States to this day, a person with Down syndrome or another or other cognitive disability may not immigrate to this country. They will be denied entry to this very day, incredibly. All the way back in the early 70s, Senator Ted Kennedy was trying to propose legislation to get rid of these kinds of laws, and it's never been done. So if you have a child with an intellectual disability, you're going to find that the United States doesn't want you, as though it's going to contaminate people. And this kind of thinking is really, it's really medieval. It's harmful. It's prejudicial. And people with Down syndrome are, you know, even if they have an intellectual impairment, these are wonderful people who can really bring joy to their families, their friends, and they can improve their own intellectual abilities through many of these same kind of methods that are discussed in my book. It used to be thought that someone with Down syndrome, you couldn't do anything for these people. Now we know that they benefit from the same kinds of stimulation that help all of us.
So that pretty much puts, what's the genetic component, or is there one? One child seems to be really sharp. But then here comes the little one, and that's the actual mastermind, is the little one, you know, the new one.
Every parent knows that kids come into this world with some basic abilities, right? We all know that. We've all seen that there are, and we know that from school. From the time we were in first grade, we could look around and notice that there are kids that are just crazy smart. My oldest friend that I knew since kindergarten is a super bright guy. He's always been smart. He's always going to be smart. I know that part of it was his upbringing. I mean, his family had a chessboard in their living room. They had paintings on their walls of great artists. They had stacks of books everywhere. They talked about interesting things. They went to different places. They went. The father took swimming lessons and took the kids for swimming lessons. They did everything to help stimulate their kids. But there is some genetic component. I mean, you'd be in fantasy land to say that your innate qualities mean nothing. I mean, because if your innate qualities mean nothing, then how come your dog can't learn to play chess? I mean, we know that the brain is an organism, and it does have some capacity limits. But what, you know, when you think about it, the difference between, you know, sometimes racism gets into this, right? So people will say, oh, one minority group or another is smarter or brighter, and the problem is that there's a whole circular element to this innate, what you think is innate, because what's the difference between a group that values learning gives their kids piano lessons, takes them to the gym, makes sure they get plenty of fresh sunshine, talks with them endlessly, stimulates them, has plenty of books, is loving and caring and calm and peaceful. What's the difference between that group who you might go, oh, they're smarter, versus another group that through the accidents of history, you know, African Americans brought over in chains, right, subjected to hundreds of years of brutality and destroying their family, right, prohibited from reading. Now you start off, okay, 1865, hey, you're all free, go for it. Suddenly suddenly we expect them to be performing at the same level as people that have been gotten all these benefits. So it's nature is a big part of it, but nurture is huge. And no one knows at this time, no one knows the limits of the power of nurture and exposing people to stimulation and treating their minds to puzzles and all the things that can help your mind grow.
Excellent. There are a bunch of people who'd like to talk to you, Dan, so why don't we bring one on? Stephen in Eugene, Oregon, on Astro Line number 2. Come on.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. I was wondering if you happened to hear about this study by the neuroscientists from MIT, and they're examining the effects of a type of drug called HDAC2 inhibitor, which supposedly removes traumatic memories, and they're looking at it as a potential drug to treat PTSD. And the fact of this whole thing is kind of scary. I mean, if they can start erasing memories selectively, what's to stop them from eradicating memories altogether, or this becoming some kind of just out of control government thing at some point?
Stephen, that's a really good question. I'm aware of these studies where they have been able to selectively block a memory, and some researchers have been able with animal models, like with mice and such, they've been able to, for instance, they can make animals think they can actually manipulate memories with various techniques where they can make them remember, and then they can expose them to there's these called optogenetics, where they literally have a light that they can turn on inside their brain. It sounds really crazy. It clicks on some neurons that they've made light sensitive, right? And they can make that mouse remember the fearful memory. They can turn it off, make them forget the fearful memory. They can change it. They can make the mouse think that it's afraid of something else. This is really crazy, weird stuff. It sounds like science fiction, but you know, when you stop and think about it, the brain is—it's kind of a machine. It's not a machine like, you know, it's not made of silicon, it's not made of steel, but it's physical. It's physical, and you know, humans love to manipulate the physical world, and they are getting so good at this, these scientists, that they can shift these things. Now, post-traumatic stress disorder is a really terrible problem for soldiers who are disabled by this. I mean, their lives can be ruined by witnessing some awful event. You know, if you see your best buddy have his head blown off in front of you, and at the same moment you're experiencing that blast, and you know, if you've ever experienced a sudden violent event, boy, you remember that, right? You will remember that. And that's often in childhood. Those are some of the first memories people will have. I still remember the time my father was walking through a doorway and spilled a hot, I pushed into him and a hot cup of coffee got spilled on my head. Boy, do I remember that. I'll always remember that. So these kinds of memories, when they interfere with your life, can be so disabling. People that are victims of crimes, violence, can really be trauma. It's not just that it's an unhappy memory. We all have unhappy memories. It's that it becomes disabling. It can really mess you up. It can make these people really unable to function. It ruin their marriage, ruin their job, just leave them in a shambles. So to find a way to help these folks is a really valuable goal. I mean, these are people in suffering who need help. And if they can safely find a way to selectively help them, not forget the memory. You're never going to forget that memory. But to no longer be disabled by it, that is a worthy goal. To be able to go, yep, I remember that time. It was terrible, but now I'm here and I'm okay and I'm going to move on with my life. As opposed to I'm going to become a drug addict because I can't handle it. I'm going to become an alcoholic. My life is going to be ruined because I can't deal with that memory. It's leaving me in a panicked state the rest of my life. So to be able to fix that would be a wonderful, wonderful thing. And it doesn't have to be as, every tool can be used for bad things. A hammer can build a house, or a hammer could hurt somebody. So it's how you use these tools that really are what matters.
How about a first-time caller, John, up there in Boeing country, up there in Everett, Washington? How are you?
Hello. Good morning, John. And thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for making it.
I grew up in a very dysfunctional family. Alcoholic mother, alcoholic father, a lot of abuse. My father took off when I was 13 years of age. This was way back in the 1967, 68, around then. I'm 59 years old now. I quit high school right after my 16th birthday. I had my mother sign me out. She got a letter from school saying, is your son intending to come to school this year? Because the first 2 years in high school, I was in class probably 20 days, if that many. Quit high school. Between the ages of 16 and 18, I tried to take the GED three times and failed math every single time. Now, back in them days, it was like five tests, and I just gave up. You know what? I'm going to be a high school dropout. I'm not going to ever be anything. I'm never going to accomplish much in life. And that's kind of the pattern of my way my life went. I started drinking. I started drugging. I did all the things, kind of what you just mentioned, Dan. And at the age of 37, I was in Las Vegas. And I had to get out of Vegas because I also developed an affinity for gambling. And, you know, drinking and drugging and gambling, living in Vegas is the wrong place to be, you know.
Go along pretty quick, John. We're getting tight on time.
Okay. Anyway, I went up to Salt Lake City, and I had an opportunity to take the GED and go back to high school. Essentially go back to high school and for my GED. I took it, and at the age of 37 now, I passed every single test, and my math level, and they told me that there was not going to be any algebra, or I couldn't even do fractions.
I'll tell you what, just John, just hold on the line for a second here, because we must take this computer-generated break. We cannot override it. It is all powerful. We'll be back with the remains of John's call and the final segment with Dan Hurley. his book Smarter. Stand by. All right, before we do this last little floating break, let's get the remainder of John's call. So you went back and you took your tests and you did well, but they said there will be no algebra, there will be no calculus, and just carry on, John.
The first six questions, or the first eight questions, were algebra. I was like, oh, my God. And but I took it, and I got I got six out of the eight questions correct, and I passed the test. But what I found absolutely amazing is that I also took an aptitude test to get into a junior college of sorts, a business college. And they told me that I had a reading level of 15th grade and a math level of 10th grade. I didn't get out of the 10th grade. And, I've never been a big reader, but I just don't, you know, there's always been something that, you know, I could fixate on and, you know, just grasp an understanding of, you know, of it for some reason. I don't know, you know, I can't explain it, but, you know, quite often I've been told I should do things and it takes me a long time to get things, you know, to complete it or to go for it, you know. I guess that's quite evident in the fact that I went from the age of 18 to 37 without so much even thinking about taking the GED test. Now, now I'm 59, and I've been told several times because I write, you know, I do blogs, I do this, and I have people tell me, oh, my gosh, you brought me to tears. I feel your pain, I feel your joy, I feel everything that you, but I just can't go that next step. I want to say, Dan, you know what, I've heard a few people talk about your book, and I'm going to pick it up probably the first of the month. I'm on SSI. I suffer from PTSD also. I had a very abusive father, sexually and physically. My mother found her brother dead at the age of, he was like 32 years old in his bedroom. A lot of trauma and a lot of things. And I just wanted to say, you know what, I really enjoyed listening to you. John, he was a great first-time guest. And, you know, I hope you get him back another time.
All right, John.
Thanks.
Thank
you very much.
Well, that was kind of a tough row he had to hoe.
Yeah, and you know, honestly, you know, when I told that story at the beginning of a couple hours ago, you know, the fact that I didn't start reading until third grade, my parents divorced. My dad was a very heavy drinker. There was a lot of disruption in my family, and people that think that just because they failed at one time that they'll never do it. You know, I just really want to applaud John for his story there. That just having faith in yourself and being willing to give it a try. To try again is such a huge part of this. And the pain that people feel about their abilities, you know, I think part of that whole evil genius thing and making fun of smart people, part of that I think is really covering up the enormous pain that a lot of us feel when we think we're stupid. You know, your IQ is something that, you know, it's one of the most private things, and people that think, one of the worst experiences I had as a kid was thinking I was stupid, and that is a really, you know, when parents yell at their kids, you're stupid, you'll never amount to anything, that is one of the most soul-killing things happen to a person, because, you know, to be human is you know, our intelligence is really central to our identity at some level.
Sure.
You know, I'm not saying for everybody. Listen, there's, you know, there's truck drivers out there. There's people that, you know, are making their living, working hard, and they don't have to maybe be geniuses. But still, we all have, we can all remember what it felt like back in school when the teacher asked you to stand up and say something and you didn't know the answer. Boy, you feel, to feel stupid is, it's a really tough thing. And to realize that that you can improve your abilities, that, like as John said, you can give it a try. You know, I don't care if you're 37 or 77 or 87, you can improve your intellectual abilities. And, you know, it's not just intellectual, like being a pointed-headed geek. This is stuff that's really heavy to people. And, you know, I just hope that if people take anything away from my book, Smarter, it's that they, you know, don't let anybody ever tell you that you're dumb, that you're never going to amount to anything. You can pick yourself up and do better. And, you know, I hope that, you know, getting through the experience of feeling stupid is something that none of us need to, you know, need to feel, should feel shame about. You know, even today, if you're overweight, you used to be able to call someone fat and everyone would laugh. Now you can't do that, right? Because now we're finally sensitive to obesity. But
sure,
stupid is kind of the last thing you can still laugh at people about. Gee, isn't he dumb? And it's really not a laughing matter. It's a really heavy, sensitive, personal thing that has a lot to do with human dignity.
Yeah, Carrie shot a little email our way and said, this is the argument for emotional intelligence being as important, if not more so, than cognitive intelligence. I think that's kind of strong. Thanks for that note, Carrie. Let's take our little break real quick and come back for our final segment with Dan Hurley. His book is Smarter, The New Science of Building Brain Power on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Dan, I got a quick one for you here. I say it's a quick one, maybe not. People are beginning to repeat over and over again that our country, our particular part of the world, our civilization, America, is getting dumber, dumbed down by professional sports and too much TV, too much violence on every screen that we come across, too much being absorbed into our smartphones and so forth. Do you find that to be the case, or do you think as a civilization, Are we still one civilization, or have we fragmented into the apathetic ones who are not going forward with their learning and their brain development because they've become despondent over their idea of what the future holds for them? Or are we moving along? Are we as dumb as people are starting to think that we are and express that opinion?
Well, there's two parts to this question. So as a society, overall, if you look at us all together, there is no question that people today are significantly smarter than they were 100 years ago, on average. In fact, IQ tests over the past 100 years, you know, they're all based on 100 is average, right? 100 is supposed to be dead average. Well, every 5 or 10 years, they've noticed that the average gets a little higher, and they've got to rejigger what is 100. And over 100 years, we are about 20 IQ points smarter than people were 100 years ago. Kids are coming up continuously a little smarter than their grandparents, even their parents, like a few IQ points every decade. And this has been seen not just in the United States and Europe. It's been shown in South America. It's now been seen substantially in China, which, you know, 30 years ago, they were, and 40 years ago, they were dealing with starvation, deprivation, very, very backward education system or no education at all. They have seen incredible gains. So as a whole society, people are a little sharper, right? People are better able to deal with complex. If you look at movies today, even these video games, if you had tried to show these to people 100 years ago, they would have looked a little glassy-eyed and gone, what is this? What? I can't follow this. If you look at those silent movies that were made 100 years ago, they look like children's stories. They're very, very simple, and they were because they were designed for the average person. So as a people, and this is one of the best examples of that you can improve people's abilities. If you couldn't improve, if you couldn't make people smarter, how can our whole society be 20 IQ points smarter than they were 100 years ago? That is a testament to the effects of your environment and your education and your diet and living in a complex society. Now, the other question is there are there some people that are really moving far ahead and some people that are really falling behind in our society? Are there winners and losers? And that, unfortunately, is the case. There are, you know, there are families that value education, aren't letting their kids watch TV all day, telling them to get outside and play, having them read, doing all sorts of things. You know, we hear about soccer moms who try to encourage their kids to do everything. And then there are people that are doing the opposite and letting their kids just, you know, sit in front of the TV and do nothing and eat McDonald's and kind of veg out. So another point of my book is to say that we need as a society to begin helping kids of every social group, every income level, every ethnic group to develop their abilities to the fullest and get the stimulation that they need to grow.
Excellent. Let's talk to Michelle in Wisconsin. I think she's still there on number four.
Hi, John.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good tonight. I'm really, I have a couple of questions for your guest. I'm wondering how he can define smarter when there are so many different forms of intelligence. And let me just go on to explain what I mean by that. When he was talking about eugenics and the differences between the racial groups, and what he seemed to be describing was that the white group nurtures their children better. I have a dispute with that. In the first place, because...
No, I didn't get that from what he was saying at all.
I did, because he said, well, one group, they give their child piano lessons, and they encourage this, and the other group, because they've been oppressed, don't seem to really value intelligence. I don't find that to be true based on my own experience. I did grow up in a multicultural area of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Sherman Park, and... I experienced the best of both worlds. So let me just take this to where I really wanted to take it, which was hip-hop music. So me being an only child in a multicultural area, I did have piano lessons. I was given privileges that other kids in the neighborhood weren't, and they were marginalized as far as being considered intelligent or not intelligent. But when I got in my late teens and early 20s, I had a friend who did hip-hop music, and we'd sit in his basement, and he'd have these guys who were high school dropouts and working in fast food places, freestyle hip-hop, freestyle to beats that he made that they would have to prove that they were in the moment that they were in by rhyming about what was going on. Complex rhymes, not just, you know, rhyming said with head and stuff like that. I mean,
right.
Very complex, and it's an art form. It's such a undervalued art form. I don't know what's happened to it. The mainstream media has ruined that as well. But this is a type of intelligence I'm wondering if he's ever had an opportunity to measure that. It's a lost art form now, so I'm hoping people are still doing it in their basements. But this was during the late 80s and early 90s, and these people would have been considered marginalized and dropouts of high school, not thinking they had much of a future, but so smart. I mean, rhyming off the top of their head off of any topic. Intelligent things, too, like KRS-One, talking about the brutality and the oppression and the history and tying that in with, as I said, things that were going on right in the room so they couldn't be writing it and, you know, just presenting it, stuff like that. And like I said, I was privileged to have had the best of both worlds. And then years later, I did finally, so I was too shy to go on the mic because I rap too, but I was nowhere near these guys. But in my late 30s, I did go online and find a website and did some freestyles, nothing like what I heard in the 90s. But did he ever measure anything like that? And how can, young people who are marginalized be encouraged in areas that they may be far more intelligent than the general population? And
okay, I get you. Okay, go ahead and respond to that, Dan.
Michelle, you know, if I said anything that made it sound like I'm making assumptions about, you know, different ethnic groups, what I'm trying to talk about is the concerns that all well-meaning people have that, you know, there's been continuing education achievement gaps in, say, in Black Americans, Hispanics, and people want to help and make a difference, and they're trying to figure out what can we do that will work. Now, absolutely, I am amazed at the incredible wordplay, the wit, the intelligence that you see in these rap and all of this kind of incredible. I mean, I am one of my few, I'm one of the few people in my neighborhood that will listen to this music, and I get such a kick out of it. It is amazing stuff, and it demonstrates the intelligence of people that you might think are, you might not think that they're that way. I went to a school in high school with people that were, you know, some of them were dropouts. I myself got a GED. I went to a high school that was not accredited with a bunch of kids who were, some of them were really struggling. And I've always admired people that are maybe overlooked and put down by society at large for seeming like they don't have what it takes. Maybe
but they do.
They didn't come from the right family.
And, but they do.
They have what it takes, and it's really a matter of believing in yourself. And, intelligence is something that can be applied to anything. If music is your thing, it can be applied there. If sports is your thing, we all talk about a smart ball play on the basketball court. That's a phenomenal part of intelligence.
Dan, we got to go. We got a show. But thank you so much for these 3 hours. They have been fascinating. And that's danhurley.com. And we hope that you will come back and join us again in the near future. We want to keep up with you. Thank you very much.
A privilege.
As he put in his book, a quote from Hamlet, "We know what we are, but know not what we may be." If I drop off the scope, come to caravantomidnight.com. You'll find me. And make ready for what's to come. Good night.